history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some stories out there that might raise your eyebrows a little bit, and you're never going to hear them unless we take the time to ask a few questions and listen to what comes back. We want to honor our veterans for their service and the sacrifices they've made. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And as we take that journey, we learn a lot. We're educated, we're entertained, and so often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Today, I'm in Henderson, Nevada with 92-year-old Bob Kamen, a veteran of the Army Air Corps in World War II, with a duty you may not have heard before. And we're going to explore that today. We're going to learn about Operation Ivory Soap. What in the world could that be? He's going to tell us. But let's start out early, Bob. You grew up in the Midwest, in Chicago, Illinois?
That's right, Chicago, Illinois, in 1925.
What part of Chicago did you grow up in?
Northwest Side.
And you had a pretty big family, didn't you?
Well, I had six siblings together with those two sisters, three brothers.
And where did you fit in out of those six?
The bottom. The last one. The baby of the family.
So what was that childhood like? I mean, this is the Great Depression in Chicago. We've heard a lot of stories about that, but how'd you experience it?
A lot of it was hard work for my mother, mainly. And, like, we'd go out and for heat and stuff for the furnace for our house. They were ripping up Lawrence Avenue. And we picked up the wood blocks that were tarred. They made good firewood for the furnace. Messed up the furnace quite a bit. We had heat that way.
Could you see that at the time, that this was not normal, that these were extreme circumstances?
Actually, I think we had more fun then than the kids do now. Now the kids have more control of their parents, I think, than we did. And even though my mother was alone, she could still hit us pretty well.
Well, yeah, and your mother was alone because you lost your father when you were how old?
5 years old. So never really knew him. The only thing I remember him getting mad at me for painting his Ford fender white. And just a little bit of it, but that was what I did for him.
What happened to him?
He died a normal death. He actually caught pneumonia, I think, and died after that. So knew nothing about him. He worked in a big brick factory on the river. That's about all I knew about him.
Well, and you said that you think kids had more fun then than kids have now. So what were those activities? What were you doing?
Well, when we had a scooter or something, we roller skates, we built our own scooters with box and a 2x4, put roller skates on it, and used it as a scooter, actually, and that's what we did.
Do you remember in those years as a boy having some ambitions or some dreams or some thoughts, hey, when I grow up, here are the things I'm going to do?
No, not really. I was too young to figure out what was going on. At the end, I figured out that when we moved to Des Plaines, quite a while later when I married, that if you have a couple of gangsters living close to you in the town, nobody will come steal anything from you. Because we had a lieutenant from one of the gangs in Chicago living in back of us, which was quite a deal.
Well, and most of us, I don't think we can understand what this would be like. But you say the gangs, and in Chicago in the 20s and 30s, I mean, the gangs ruled everything, right?
Well, they more or less did, but they were still there when I left. The head syndicate was still around there.
So is that something where even the kids were aware of who Al Capone was or Dutch Schultz or some of those guys?
They never bothered us. There was nothing to worry about.
Is it safe to say if you grew up on the northern end of Chicago that you were a Cubbies fan?
Oh, yeah. I did a number of games there when I was working because we had to televise them at that time.
Yeah, after the war, you worked in the television business for a long time. So you worked on the crew, the television crew at Cubs games at Wrigley.
Yeah, Cubs and White Sox, any games that were around, and golf and whatever for the remotes. I was in the studio most of the time. I'd go out on a couple of remotes occasionally, but that was it.
So as a kid, was there a particular ball player that you appreciated or admired or looked up to?
No, not really, because we couldn't afford to go to the games, actually, and they're quite a ways from us. We were busy playing baseball ourselves.
Did you play sports for your school or anything?
No, none of them. Well, I quit high school when I was 16, and I graduated by taking tests to get the diploma from high school. Because I went in the Air Force as a cadet, not knowing that I'd end up on a board ship for 16 months.
And this is where that Project Ivory Soap comes in, which we're going to hear about. Tell me about, though, a day when you were 16 that I'm sure you remember, because it seems like everybody remembers. December 7th, 1941, when the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor. Do you remember getting word of that?
We knew there was war going on then, and people were going to it because they were had to save the countries and everything. But that was about it. We got drafted or going in. Well, I enlisted, but the ones that got drafted were Army. But I decided I wanted to be a pilot, which I didn't make because they had more pilots then than they knew what to do with.
You mentioned, though, quitting school when you were 16. Why'd you do that? What was the motivating factor?
I had to work to help support the family, so I worked for a couple of years before going in the service.
And again, today, a lot of people just can't understand that or identify it, but you talk about it, you're one of six siblings, and your mother is a widow, yeah. So if your family's going to eat, you felt like you had to go earn a little money.
That's about it, because she didn't have enough money to really go on her own, as she wasn't working, and she was taking care of the kids. My older sister helped take care of the kids when they were growing up, but she got married very shortly, and that left the second one of my older brothers, and the rest of us to get money and live. But we're all happy.
And you said you worked for a couple of years before you joined the Army Air Corps. What kind of work were you doing?
Factory work, really. A spot welder in one place, mixed chemicals in another place. That was about it for two jobs I had.
So what was it that made you decide, I'm going to try to be a pilot, I'm going to enlist in the Army Air Corps?
I don't know, I just liked flying. I thought it would be fun, but I didn't make it.
So walk us through that. How'd that unfold? You enlist with that idea, I'm going to be a pilot, and how long was it until they said, sorry, that's not happening?
Shortly after I finished basic down in Miami Beach, and there I was living pretty well. We had a hotel across from the water. From there, we went to Gulfport, I think it was Mississippi. And from there, we were assigned into the 2nd ARU, which was in Alabama, which was quite a nice place. We learned how to jump off a ship, and we had built a tower there high enough to be what our ship would be. And if it got hit, we'd be gone. So we'd have to get off.
So you sign up wanting to become a pilot in the Army Air Corps, and they stick you on a ship because the 2nd ARU, which I think probably a lot of people, when they hear ARU, they're not going to know what you're talking about. And there's plenty of acronyms they do know, but that's one you don't hear about too often. And in fact, your duty was actually secret. It was classified for more than a half century. So tell us what the 2nd ARU was.
The 2nd ARU is an Air Force repair unit that's floating. And we had every type of instrument people on the ship that could do instruments, tires, oxygen. We could do anything for an airplane from that ship. And we were actually there for the B-29s if they had to land there. But a couple of them did land, but they didn't come out too well.
And so this is something that was put together, and when I said Ivory Soap, that was the name given to this mission, because everybody knows Ivory Soap floats in a bathtub, and you guys would be floating out there like bars of soap as a resource for the B-29s. They hadn't had this in the European war, and they didn't really need it, I guess, because they had so many air bases in England?
There were 6 ships that were developed this way, and where the other 5 were, I have no idea. We were at Saipan. We could see the planes taken off from Tinian. And after the Evo was taken by the Marines, we were shipped over there in case that was for the fighter planes that had to escort the B-29s into Tokyo or Japan, wherever they want to go. The P-51s wouldn't make it all the way back to Saipan or Tinian, so they were Evo then. Mm-hmm. So we had plenty of work there with the P-51s. Even though we were there mainly for B-29s.
So tell us about this ship. How big was it? How many of you guys were there on the ship? What were you equipped with?
We had, actually, the Merchant Marines run the ship. We had Navy gunners aboard, and there were 280-some Army Air Force people that would repair anything on a plane. We also had an oxygen plant on the ship right in the bow, and they're continuously with ducts going back and forth to the island with the oxygen for the planes. So they kept them busy that way. I was running LCVP, landing craft personnel, and LCMs, which landing craft mechanized. But it was 16 months over there on the water.
And you guys actually had aboard, this is something that surprised me, and again, it's amazing how many different things were happening during World War II and how many of the crazy ideas actually got carried out, from tanks with strobe lights in the Mojave Desert to inflatable tanks on the beach at Normandy to Fulham to you guys in the second ARU. But if you ask somebody about helicopters, they'll say helicopters weren't a part of any war America was in until the Korean War. But you can tell us that that's not true, because you had one on your ship?
We had two of them. We started out with two. First one, we lost the Saipan for some reason. The gas wasn't kept clean or something. And then the other one was lost when we were in Evo. They were taking the colonel back to the island with one, show him how they fly. Didn't make it off. I was about 100 yards off the ship, and it just sputtered and went out. So one of the Merchant Marines had to dive in to save the colonel. He couldn't swim.
And I guess maybe that's an indication of what they were used for, just to transport people from this repair ship to other places?
Oh, at the time, yeah, we'd go into the island and repair things or take it back to the ship to repair them, or instruments. No matter what it was wrong, they could repair it on the ship. So they were used quite a bit. And actually, a lot of the guys ended up going on the island for days at a time working on the planes. So they were kept busy.
And I guess maybe we should try to explain the necessity of these, or the thinking behind their creation, these ARUs. I guess would it be safe to say it was because the Pacific campaign moved in an island-hopping fashion where they're advancing quickly, and there wouldn't be time to assemble all that repair equipment in each spot, but it was better to have a mobile repair station?
Yeah, that would be a good idea for it, especially the B-29s, which nobody knew too much about. Mm-hmm. And actually, if the one with the main bomb on it, it flew over us. But
you're talking about the Enola Gay?
Yeah. If they happen to have problems and they had land, we were it, so we could take care of the thing.
So if one of these planes had a problem and had to go down, the ship could go close enough to where they were to get to the plane and fix it?
No, they'd have to take our men and equipment into the island for the plane. If it landed, well, we had one B-29 land a couple hundred yards off in the water because they didn't want to take a chance with it on the island. And it floated there for 2 weeks, and then they towed it in. And they did, our guys did go in and fix it, actually, so it would fly again.
So a B-29 was floating in the surf for 2 weeks, and your guys got it operational again?
Yeah. Well, it was on, they towed it to the island for that. We were there to fix all planes, but it was mainly for the B-29s could make it from Tinian or Saipan to Japan. But P-51s couldn't do that, or P-47s. So they had those on Evo, and they would escort the planes in to Japan, which they did.
And you mentioned your duty of working with LCVPs and LCMs. So what were those used for? What were the nature of those trips from the ship to the island?
Transporting people and equipment, if they needed it, into the island. But they used ducks, a duck outfit that was on Iwo. They transferred all the oxygen to the island. And they had a continuous line of them going in all the time.
So you were piloting those landing craft, or?
Yeah. Well, I was piloting. We were running them. Yeah. You know, Navy would have three guys on it. We'd have one. The guy's driving it, running it, rather.
Well, and I've heard some stories from LCVP guys with regard to Iwo Jima, guys who were landing the troops there for the invasion, that was an awfully tough place to bring LCVPs into because of the surf, because of the volcanic rocks, and that wasn't an easy job. Is that what you experienced too?
We didn't have any problems. We had ducks that went into the island. Of course, we could pull our front end on it, and we had a dock out there after a while. But ducks could land on the island. They had black sand, which was so loose, no jeep or anything could run on it. They could deflate the tires on the ducks and go in. But jeeps or anything like that, they'd have to be across that black sand.
That black volcanic sand secured because of the sacrifice of so many American Marines. We'll hear more about Iwo Jima, the way Bob Kamen experienced it, more about Project Ivory Soap, a unique and groundbreaking endeavor that remained classified till the 1990s. And specifically, we'll hear about Bob's ship carrying the second ARU, which would accomplish an important first. We'll get into that. And if you'd like to dive into some photos from Bob's time in World War II, including some pretty heavy ones he took on Iwo Jima, head over to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, and we'll be right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Put $250 in a savings account and you'll start earning dividends. Who else is going to do that for you? And access? So easy. Over 30,000 ATMs. Free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Again, the website myeecu.org, or just pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Our guest today, 92-year-old Bob Kamen of Henderson, Nevada, originally from Chicagoland in the Midwest. And for 16 months in World War II, he was floating in the Pacific like a bar of ivory soap. That was the name the military gave to what was a secret operation with a vital purpose. Bob spent his time on one of the six Generals. That was the nickname for six Liberty ships converted to ARUs, aircraft repair units. They were all named after generals. Bob was on the second ARU, the Liberty ship Rebecca Lukens, renamed the SS Major General Herbert A. Darg, which was actually the very first floating maintenance depot to ever operate in a combat zone. Of course, Bob didn't know that when this Army Air Corps cadet headed to Mobile, Alabama, and took over the Grand Hotel, where their training included abandoned ship drills in which they'd jump from a 30-foot platform. He would come to see how important oxygen was. The high-altitude B-29 bombers in the Pacific needed breathing oxygen for their crewmen, but there was no oxygen generating station in the Marianas. at least not on land, there was on Bob's ship, and they would supply all the oxygen for those B-29s flying off of Tinian, like the Enola Gay and Boxcar, which would drop atomic bombs on Japan in August of 1945. These ARUs and Operation Ivory Soap also provide a great trivia question about helicopters that you can impress your friends with. I'll spell that out for you shortly. But let's get back to Bob, who had quit school at 16 to help support his widowed mother and five siblings and joined the Army Air Corps at age 18. Well, I guess I should ask you about the journey over there. Because here you sign up, you're hoping to fly, then they stick you on a ship. Had you ever been on a ship before?
Nope. Well, actually, we left Alabama from Mobile, Alabama, went through the Panama Canal. We stopped at Cuba first. And while we're out on the Caribbean, they had one sailor on a destroyer escort was with us. He got so sick because of the weather, we had to stop and tow him over to our ship, hand over hand, with him in a basket.
So they sent him in a basket across a rope from their ship to your ship?
Oh, it was hand over hand, back over, because they were afraid he'd die over there, because it was pretty rough for the smaller ship. And he did fine on ours, but it was so rough there. I had a merchant marine chase me with a knife, because I was laughing at him because he got seasick, and I didn't. Well, actually, the only time he almost got seasick was when coming from Iwo to Saipan after the war, because I didn't have points to get home with our ship. And I got over there to get breakfast one morning, and the LCP, I forget what they were called, but a bigger landing ship, but they would rock. And our breakfast or food was set up on the fantail. And I got back there and smelled the fumes from that diesel. And I said, went back up. So that's the only time I ever really come close to getting real sick.
And here you are, you're just a teenager. And you're the only one of your siblings that's serving in the war. How hard do you think that was for your mother? I mean, your father's been gone since you were five. How hard was that for your mother to see you head off to war?
Well, I'd worked before going in, and I lived away for a while I was working, and she was used to me being there or not being there. She was all right, actually.
What about you? Was there part of you that was a little nervous or scared that this is going to be a dangerous situation for you?
No, I was too stupid at that age. But let's face it, there were a couple times you got scared because you're going in rough water because they had to take the ship out and retake the boats in to the island. Like one time we were going in, and all of a sudden I see one of the other ships with all the guns on, and gun pointing at us. And I, everybody ducked, that was it. But our guy that was in charge of us, he was a sergeant. He always had his life jacket on because he couldn't swim either. So we broke his habit by throwing one over, which was water soaked so badly, it sunk. Then he got different life jackets for him.
And you described the makeup of that ship's crew. Here with the second ARU, you said the ship was run by merchant marines, you had Navy gunners, and then you had almost 300 of you guys from the Army Air Corps. So how'd everybody get along on that ship?
Fine. We had some very nice, good food. Best food they had. That's why the colonel was there when he went down. But they had a whole group of marines with them, and we invited them over for dinner, because they were getting lousy food on the island. And we had good food because when the ship would come in with supplies for the Navy leader would go over and get supplies from them. The Army did the same thing, the Air Corps. So we always had fresh fruit, everything good aboard ship. The only thing we had to worry about, I guess, why they keep it secret, because we would have been the first ship they'd have gone after, because we could get the B-29 off the ground again to go on its way.
Well, and that's an important point. So this was classified for more than a half century, and the reason it was so important to be classified then If the enemy is aware of your ship's purpose, of what you're there for, they want to take you out because then they're cutting off the lifeline to those B-29s, which would end up firebombing Tokyo and eventually dropping the nuclear bombs.
That's about it, actually. They did take care of a couple B-29s that did come in that couldn't make it over or come back, and they repaired those. And so they can go back to Tinian or Saipan.
You said 16 months on this ship. So give us a sense of a typical day for you. How would you be spending that day?
I spend a lot of time to spend half time in the water or taking people in and out from the island or going to that. And you couldn't swim in Iwo. The water was too cold. We were used to Saipan at the time, and I'd swim half the day. But then we got to Iwo, took some in, it was hot there, decided I was going go in for a swim, dove off the LCVP, and this thing stood about 2 foot off the water. And they said, yeah, the only time you ever saw me get out of the water so fast because it's so cold. I made it up there in one leap.
But the first place you guys anchored was Saipan, is that what you said?
No, we went through Panama Canal. Wait, we did stop at Cuba, too, where we anchored. Didn't have any shore leave, but we were there for a couple of days. Then we went through the Panama Canal, where we stopped at the Balboa. Went in there. We did get some shore leave there. Then we went on the Inuitok, which we could see the other side of the island from our ship, which we were happy to leave. Then we went to Saipan, and Saipan to Iwo.
And as you're going to these places, are you getting a sense of what had happened there, of what had taken place to put those islands in American hands?
We had no idea what was there and on there, because we were just a repair unit. I didn't know the guns we had. We were attacked a number of times at Iwo, and we had an 8-inch on the bow, 5-inch on the other end. The captain said, don't ever shoot that 8-inch again. They shot it once, and every plate on the ship was rattling, so he said, that thing will shake this ship apart. So they had a lot of 20s on it.
Well, and you said that so matter-of-factly, like it's not a big deal. You said we were attacked a number of times.
Air raids. We had a number of air raids. But they were after bigger ships than ours. But
it's not like they tell you that.
No. That's why it was secret, I guess, and didn't tell us even.
So what do you do when there are incoming Japanese planes and they're dropping bombs? Where do you go, and how do you handle that?
We just stayed in the lower part of the ship, except some were assigned to assist the Navy gunners. They would go up and help them, but most would stay below deck.
I was just looking at some photos in one of your albums, and there are a lot of photos there of Iwo Jima, photos of Mount Suribachi, photos of what seems like an innumerable group of white crosses in the cemetery where Marines were buried there. What did it feel like to see those kind of sites there and realize the price that had been paid to conquer that little stretch of ground?
Well, actually, I went over there to see the cemetery, and there were a lot of crosses, which I had to find a friend of mine in the States. His brother was buried there, so I got pictures of his cross for the friend of mine in the States. He was one of the Marines that didn't make it. Actually, when we pulled in the Iwo, there was bodies in the water from the Japanese and the island people that were forced to live there at the time. We're jumping off the cliff to get away because we were not friends at that time.
Well, how does a teenager handle seeing that, pulling up in an island and seeing bodies floating by?
It's not a nice sight to see, really, but it's worse when you see when they're burying the Japanese at that time. Well, you see pictures of them burying people in the movies. They had pictures of them putting the Japanese in graves with big truckloads of them and just covering them up. They didn't have crosses for them, but it was something different.
And you were able to find the specific cross honoring your friend's brother?
Yeah. Got a picture. I don't know if it's in my book or not, but I gave him one too.
What was his name, the one who died?
Coffin. My friend was Jim. He was Robert. I found it fairly easy. But they had some kind of plan or layout for the thing so they could find them, like cemeteries do now.
I don't want to put thoughts in your head or words in your mouth or be melodramatic, but when you're looking at a cross among thousands of other crosses on this little volcanic island, and the name there is Robert, do you imagine, hey, that could have been me?
No, it couldn't have been me, because I wasn't a Marine, and the Marines were the, well, when we were on the island there, we had a small base, and I felt sorry for the Marines that took the island. They came around, marched in full gear, heavy knapsacks, the whole thing. And they're marching around the island, keeping them up for the next battle, which I felt sorry for them more than me, because I knew what I had. Maybe get hit by something or ship sink, but that was about it.
So it sounds like, in your view, your job wasn't that difficult, or your duty wasn't that bad.
No, it wasn't, actually. I had good food, good clean spot to sleep. It wasn't like Marines had to go in and fight. It was rough sometimes getting in because of the weather, but that was the closest thing we had to worry about. Like a ship would take off when we got on the island. When rough weather come on, it couldn't take the weather there close to the island. So they'd take off for a while. We'd take the smaller boat into the island and stay there. That's the only time we really worried. The only time I really thought it was funny thing, the lieutenant that was in charge, he was also one of the helicopter pilots. He come running out and he said, wait, and I'll go in with you. And he went down to get something, come back up, and about that time the wave coming at us was about over the ship, higher than the ship. He says, go ahead, I'll wait here. So we took it in, but he wasn't going to go in then.
And you mentioned that the Enola Gay, on its fateful mission in August of 1945, that it actually flew right over you guys?
We didn't know it was coming, because nobody knew that, but we knew the B-29s were flying over close to us all the time, really. Not close, but pretty high up when they come by us, because they had oxygen and everything else aboard there, so they could be up maybe 30,000 feet up there.
And you got, that was one of the things you guys did, was provided some of that oxygen for them?
We supplied tanks of it, not just for the B-29s, but for the P-51, P-47s. Because they needed it too. They would take the B-29 into Tokyo. Actually, the 51s were pretty well worn out by the time the war ended, actually.
Well, speaking of the war ending, you guys must have heard what happened in August of 45 when those bombs were dropped. Was that an eye-opener when you got the news of that?
Oh, yeah, because we had no idea the bomb was there. And that was on Tinian where they loaded it. We didn't see the plane go over, because it could have been a couple of miles one way or the other. Didn't actually know. But I knew our 51s and stuff took off. We could see that, but we didn't know the bomb was going over.
And what about that news that Japan had surrendered? How big a deal was that for you and your buddies?
We knew we could go home then, but we were all happy about that, except the ship left without me, because I didn't have the points to go back. They sent me back to Tinian, where I started taking care of electric engines for the electric on the island for the group that I was in. And from there, I went home to San Francisco. Froze my butt off in San Francisco because I was used to the warm weather, very warm weather. Got in there, it was so cold, I tried everything I could get on to keep warm. And I caught the worst cold I ever had.
And you told me you joined the Army Air Corps because you wanted to fly. Then they stick you on a ship. But I think I also heard you say you did get to ride in a B-29. How'd you pull that off?
I'm just friends with them and stuff like that. I did stuff for them. When they asked them where they're going, told them they were going to fly up and back. So got on and went with them.
So where'd you fly from? Where'd you fly to? And what was it like in between? What'd you see? What'd you experience?
All we saw was water. Because took off from Iwo, flew into over Tokyo, come back to Iwo.
And this was after Japan had surrendered?
Yeah. Yeah, we didn't go in before that. Then they wouldn't take it anywhere.
I guess I should ask you, since you were in a pretty important place as far as the world said in 1945, you're in the area where some pretty significant things happened. Who were the guys that you appreciated or admired? Maybe you even looked at them and said, yeah, those guys are heroes. Who would those people be?
The Marines, really. When I saw them marching around the island after taking the island, I thought, those guys are unbelievable. They're strong enough to take the island and then come in there. And actually, walking around that island was no fun because there was just nothing there to really see. Mount Suribachi was the only high thing. We could get on the beach, but didn't see any of those guys actually enjoying the beach or anything. The only time I saw them was when they were marching or when I went to the cemetery. There was quite a few.
Quite a few of those battle-hardened Marines visiting the cemetery on Iwo Jima, because there were nearly 7,000 Americans killed on that island in a 5-week battle. More than 19,000 more were wounded. That price of freedom is something Bob got to reflect on recently with a trip to the National World War II Memorial with Honor Flight Southern Nevada. And we're going to hear about that experience when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. Have you ever looked at a box of old videotapes or photos and said, one of these days I'm going to do something with those? I know the feeling. But more importantly, I found the solution at VHSmaster.com. VHS Master will take all your old VHS and 8mm tapes and reels and convert them to DVDs and digital videos, ensuring that your priceless memories will last for years to come. They'll even preserve and restore photos, slides, and audio cassettes. Go to VHSmaster.com. That's VHSmaster.com. And tell them you heard about them on Hometown Heroes. You hear a lot about World War II if you listen to Hometown Heroes, but have you ever wondered what it's like to be on a real World War II ship? The SS Jeremiah O'Brien, one of just two remaining operable Liberty ships, is docked at Pier 45 in San Francisco's famous Fisherman's Wharf. And the O'Brien is offering overnight programs on Fridays and Saturdays for kids ages 6 and up. Kids get to sleep on the ship in World War II bunks, have a private tour of the ship's galley, the crew quarters, guns and gun mounts, exhibits, and the crown jewel, the O'Brien's triple expansion steam engine. This is an experience like no other. For more details, call the SS Jeremiah O'Brien's office at 415-544-0100. That's 415-544-0100. Or visit the ship's website at ssjeremiahobrien.org.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, and another reminder to me of why I love doing this show so much, why it's such a thrill to meet these amazing men and women all over this great country of ours. That interaction alone is always enriching, but we also learn a lot. And one of the things I've learned with this interview is something apparently a lot of people haven't learned yet. If you go online and search for the first American military use of helicopters, you're likely to find that it was for medical evacuation during the Korean War. But Bob Kamen and the men who participated in Operation Ivory Soap during World War II can tell you that's not true. He was on one of six floating aircraft maintenance units in the Pacific, able to not only repair but also provide much-needed oxygen for the B-29s, which would eventually hasten the war's end. And every single one of those ARUs carried two primitive Sikorsky helicopters. In fact, the first ever helicopter medical evacuations were not in the Korean War. They were carried out by choppers from the 5th and 6th ARUs, rescuing wounded men from the Philippine jungles on June 16, 1945. I know you can raise some of your friends' eyebrows with that tidbit, and if you need some backup, I have documentation linked for you at hometownheroesradio.com. Bob Kamen has shared his first-person memories of the helicopters on his ship, the 2nd ARU, which combined Navy, Merchant Marines, and Army Air Corps troops to accomplish its unique purpose. Bob enlisted in the Air Corps because he wanted to fly. Then he spent all of his World War II time on a ship. But he can count a very special flight as his most recent adventure, and we'll get to that as we examine a bit of his life after World War II. You came home from the war. Eventually, you met one of your neighbors named Carolyn, who you didn't know was there the whole time, hidden in plain sight, or what?
No, she was on the corner a lot there. I spotted her because she was out cutting the grass. She's a beautiful girl with a terrific body. So the next week, a friend of mine and I took her and another girl out to a lake, Crystal Lake. They had a swim there. Went with her steady ever since then. And they've been married for 68 years. Then she left us.
68 years of marriage and kids and grandkids and great-grandkids. When did you start going to these annual reunions of the second ARU?
So I didn't make the first one, 51st one I did. They were all over the country, really. We had about 8 of them before so many died with age that we just broke up then.
And I'm just guessing, I have a feeling maybe that going to those reunions, maybe you learned some things that you hadn't been aware of during the war.
Well, that's where we learned that we were a secret outfit. We didn't know that before that.
So the first time you found out that your duty in World War II was classified was 52 years later when they told you guys it's declassified now?
Yeah, now it is. They let go of the papers.
Did you say, well, oops, I've been telling people about it all these years?
Yeah. Well, actually, I never talked about it too much. In fact, my kids didn't know too much about what I did. They didn't know I was out floating around on a ship or whatever. And after a while, that's when I told them. Then they started asking questions.
And how'd you get into television?
I went to school for it to start with, American Television Institute. Started that in ABC in Chicago.
You carried out a number of different roles in television production over all those years. What were the things that you enjoyed doing the most?
Well, actually, I enjoyed doing sound effects. I was part of the shows then. The other times you're on camera or boom or whatever. It just seemed like with the sound effects, I was actually part of the show. Like my son says, in school one time, they asked him what the father did. My son comes up. I was a duck. I looked at him. Even the teacher had to come find out what's going on. But he wouldn't back down on it. Did get fan letters for the duck that I would argue with the people on the screen. It was a big part of the show, really. The ant army and all different types of sound effects for the show.
I bet you you worked with or interacted with some people whose names we might know also.
Well, Charlton Heston come in. This is when I was the TD.
That's technical director.
Yeah. He came in and sat in back of me. It was a Saturday afternoon. And he's talking, asking questions about what I'm doing. And all of a sudden, the stage manager from the show he was supposed to be on comes looking for him. I didn't know it was Charlton Heston at the time. He come in all alone.
Well, I don't want to miss anything from your time in World War II, and feel free to throw in anything you think is relevant. But I know you've had an adventure just in the last couple years that maybe brought some of those memories coming back. Your son went with you, and Honor Flight of Southern Nevada took you and a bunch of other veterans from here in Vegas back to Washington, D.C. to see a lot of impressive and moving sights. What about that National World War II Memorial, where the big fountains in the middle and the Pacific and the Atlantic and the wall of gold stars for 400,000 guys like you who didn't come home?
Actually, that thing was beautiful. They had plaques all around the thing. It was, I'd say, half a block in size, square. You enjoyed seeing all the plaques and the fountain and everything in there. It was a very good deal. They had it set up beautifully so we could see all this. Because they had time to spend there.
When you looked at all those gold stars, did you think about guys like Robert Coffin or maybe others who you knew who didn't have the life that you had after the war?
Yeah, because the number of stars there were amazing. But then you read what they represented. Like, each star was not one person. I think it was 100 people for that one star. And there looked like thousands of stars there. And you felt bad for it, but there's nothing you can do, of course. You, like, enjoyed that all that much more. But actually run into another unit from Washington, I think it was, the guy that actually restarted the things for the different states to do this. And he was explaining different plaques, which was very interesting.
Is that Earl Morse, the guy who started Honor Flight? Is that who you're talking about?
Yeah.
I'm sure there were things you expected to happen, and you knew some of the places you were going to go. But was there anything that happened that surprised you, that you didn't expect, that maybe was a pleasant surprise?
The escort from monument to monument with a police escort in front of you, thinking, what are these people that are taking off to the side from this motorcycle policeman going through, wondering, who the heck is on that bus? About 30 of us.
Well, I imagine that the royal treatment didn't end there. What was waiting for you when you landed back here in Las Vegas?
Hundreds of people shaking our hand, bands and different things all over the airport. In fact, we had two welcoming committees there. When we got off the plane, and then halfway through, another group was there wanting to see us, shake our hands, hear stories. The kids were the main thing there. Beautiful little kid. She was interested in how old I was, mainly to be in the Second World War. She never knew really what it was. And Boy Scouts were there to greet us. The bands were Army, Navy, bagpipes were there, everything. But we were really surprised to see such a welcoming committee when we were coming home.
And I'm just guessing, but there are probably a lot of years where you might have felt that nobody really cared whether or not you were in the service.
Yeah, because I don't know how many years back it was. That was when I was still working. There's a bunch that said, we shouldn't have dropped a bomb on Japanese. That was bad. We shouldn't have done that. But they forgot that there's been thousands more killed on our side and theirs if the war had continued.
Maybe millions more.
Yeah, that's true. That did bring it to an end, which was good.
So that whole honor flight experience, how'd that make you feel? And did it make you look at your own military service any differently than you had before?
No, actually it didn't. I enjoyed being honored with it, with the people. I never shook so many hands in my life as I did there. But knowing that there's other men in the war, in our group, that did a lot more dangerous things than I did, where I was sleeping in clean quarters most of the time. I knew the other guys were shot at and went on beaches. I didn't have to do that, which I would find myself happy or lucky that I didn't, because I could have been dead just like he were.
Well, I don't want to forget to say thank you. Thank you for serving our country, and thank you for telling us your story. When you think about your time in the Army Air Corps, is there something that you'd say you're most proud of?
Well, being there for the planes when they came in, if they came in needed repair. We got the equipment, the men that could repair it, and we had aboard our ship people that could shoot the guns, were trained at them, and the merchant marines take us around. I felt myself very lucky.
Well, we're just about out of time, Bob, but for the sake of your 4 kids, 3 grandkids, and 6 great-grandkids, who wouldn't be here if you didn't make it home from World War II, after seeing a list of 10 air raids that your ship endured, I just want to make sure you didn't leave out any details about close calls you might have had all those years ago.
Well, we were in the air attacks, but they weren't after our ship because it's a Liberty ship. That's nothing. They went after the bigger ships.
Well, and maybe that's an important point we didn't hit on, because Liberty ships, I mean, there were so many of them, they could make them in practically 10 minutes at Kaiser Shipyards in the Bay Area. So you guys were kind of in disguise. You looked like any other Liberty ship. You just had a very different purpose.
Yeah, because we did have a helicopter pad, but they wouldn't know what that was on there. If they found out we were there for B-29s, they would have been after us. We did get one Japanese plane that we actually shot down. That was an evil. It was just something that had to be done. That was the war that was fought actually to save everybody, to save the world, I think. We were out there secret because other people were dying for these islands, and these islands were not easy to take.
And you said a lot of guys died to take those islands. And, you know, throughout World War II, 406,000 Americans died while serving our country. How should we remember those guys? Guys like Robert Coffin, who you mentioned. How should they be remembered now?
Remember, they're there to help this country, to keep their democracy and enjoy it.
Well, I ask you what you're most proud of, but at age 92, what would you say you're most thankful for?
Being here yet. Being with my wife for 68 years was the biggest thing. It was a great marriage.
I guess one more thing on the Project Ivory Soap. Were you guys aware that that was the name the government had given to this ARU idea?
No, that came out after we were, you know, one of the reunions. We're just a landing craft repair unit. Actually, I don't think we thought we were that big, and there's only six of us, six ships.
Did you guys get a chuckle out of that? The Ivory Soap thing? That's kind of a funny name to give this important military operation, right?
I don't know where they got it, really. Because all we're doing is floating around like Ivory Soap does.
A little piece of history I'd never heard of before, and I'm guessing you hadn't either. That's Bob Kamen, 92 years old, of Henderson, Nevada. Don't forget to find photos of Bob then and now at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. Thanks so much for listening today. I'm Paul Leffler, hoping you'll join us again next time when we're reminded once more through the stories of our veterans that freedom is not free. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, and then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they go into your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. It gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.